My name is Lawrence Allen.
I'm Ronald Shaw.
I'm Rahul Vora.
And this is Bad Time Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Bad Time Radio. And this time, Ronald and Rahul are both out. And this is actually a weird story. But anyways, before we get into that, I got Dan, you know, classic. But then I got Dan's friend, Ronnie. So it's basically like the Thronderdome plus Lawrence, except we're not going to talk about Timothy Zahn tonight.
Yeah. It's the great Thronderdome takeover. It's wacky. This is like when all your favorite stars of Friends were on The Single Guy.
God damn. Sorry. No, I'm looking over. We are having my brother-in-law come over to watch the baby tonight. And yeah. So we made the bed in the room that I'm in very nicely. And my dog, who I let into this room because he likes being in the same room as me, just systematically unmade the bed and then lay down on a part of the bed that he had not unmade. So...
Classic dog.
Yeah, I love you, Yorick, but you make strange decisions. So anyways, and we're talking about the film Blackmail. We had originally been trying to record this, I believe, about a month ago, but then, like, literally the day before we were going to record it, my wife went into labor, and we were in the hospital with a newborn, when we were supposed to be recording this. And I couldn't really say, hey honey, you know, hold our kid, I'm going to go talk with two strangers about a terrible 90s movie. So, yeah. And since they were going to be out, I thought we'd take another run at it. And as for the movie selection, so I've noticed that if you listen to Dan on podcasts, he talks about this movie a lot. And I thought it'd be fun to like just make a podcast about it.
I'm realizing that I might have the same relationship to this movie that Ronnie has to Fanboys, in that I might be the only person not involved in its production who has seen it like four or five times by this point.
I've seen it twice now because of this goddamn podcast.
Yeah, and you sound appropriately angry about the fact. I don't know. So where did you first encounter this, and why does it occupy such a space in your psyche, Dan?
So this first came to my attention from a friend of mine who is now... she is a highly respected doctor, a very learned person. But she is also one of my friends in my life who has a real thirst for trash. She's one of those people that, like, when she tells you there's some crazy garbage, you take her up on it. And so this film, Blackmail, falls in a category of film that had a real run in the 90s, essentially Pulp Fiction ripoff. Now, you had a lot of people who saw the phenomenon of Pulp Fiction. They saw that, you know, an independent film got huge, got really famous, that it was like a crime thriller, you know, it was hip, all kinds of these kind of threads there. And they looked at that at one of the most, you know, I think we can say, like, whether you like him or hate him, like, Quentin Tarantino has a kind of raw talent, like one of the greatest kind of raw talents of filmmakers of the generation, and said, I could do that too.
I think what's tricky though is that Tarantino, his talent is such that it seems like it should be easy, because the conversations are the things that you remember in his movies, and they all kind of seem like just stuff that your, you know, friends who you all think are smart and hip could, you just write down what they say and then you put that in kind of a plot, and then you have you'd have a movie, right?
And right.
His direction, I mean, you don't notice it. It's good because you don't notice it, but it's not like he's doing crazy camera work and shit that would be hard to replicate. No special effects. And especially with Reservoir Dogs, he wasn't even working with that big actor. So it seems like it should be easy to replicate, but of course it isn't, because the magic is in screenwriting, which you're not Quentin Tarantino. You can't write a script like he can. You're not even Kevin Smith, really, honestly. You're nobody.
That's the other point of
comparison. I would rather watch Cop Out over this.
Yes. Well, I assume Cop Out has less gross transphobia at the very least, and edgy racism that's probably actually just racism.
Yeah, so it was so this would have been, when I first saw it, it would have been around, gosh, I want to say 2005, 2006.
And Jesus fucking Christ. Did you find it on some like petrified VHS at the bottom of a Goodwill? How did you even... I don't think this got a DVD release. Jesus.
I watched it on DVD, I think. I think it was Leanne's DVD. At this point, I don't even trust my own memory. Lawrence, I'm going to level with you. I don't know how this movie came into my life.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Well, Daniel was Googling blackmail, and this came on like the 18th page of search results.
You know, it's possible Cillian Murphy and his gang incepted the desire to watch this movie into Dan.
It might just be a curse that's been leveled on me, and I have to spread it around like that horror movie about STDs that I didn't see.
It follows.
Thank you. Yes. I hadn't seen it in many, many years before. I do not know why I was reminded of it, but it was on your podcast, Lawrence. So part of this blame falls on you.
Now, we were watching Wishmaster 2, and now you turned Wishmaster 2 off before he shows up, but Wishmaster 2 does feature Bokeem Woodbine. So I guess you remember one of the very few Bokeem Woodbine starring vehicles.
Yes, that was right. That was what our discussion was like. It was the Bokeem Woodbine headlining, which is not something you expect to see quite a lot of, and boy, after watching this one, you really don't expect to see it.
Things. It's not his fault that he sucks here. He's very good in Fargo season 2.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was going into this based on Fargo season 2. I thought if someone had actually bothered to write him a Quentin Tarantino-esque monologue, I think he could sell it, probably. It's just, for some reason, this is a Quentin Tarantino ripoff. I think it's a ripoff of something that ripped off Quentin Tarantino, because if it's a Tarantino ripoff, they forgot to put in like those like glowing monologues about some weird topic that are the hallmark of the Tarantino.
This is like a ripoff of Suicide Kings.
Yes.
See, so they forgot to put in the things like good writing monologue.
They forgot the Royale with Cheese thing, or the big dicks like a virgin. You know, the thing that everyone remembers from those movies. The thing you would try for.
They did remember to have some ironic Exotica music playing.
That's fair. Also, this movie, it's a little bit more progressive than Quentin Tarantino, because it doesn't quite have the zest for white characters saying the N-word that his work of this period did.
I actually picked up on this. I watched it again for my at least fourth time.
You have a wife and kid, man.
Look, I just had it on the background while I played Battletech. All right. That's a normal evening for me.
That's fine.
This was the first time I caught a couple of soft R N-words from the white male lead of the criminal couple.
But Bokeem Woodbine tells him to stop it. So at the very least, he recognizes on some level that white people shouldn't say that word.
He does give him the "you can't be talking like that" white baby treatment.
Although then, of course, he just responds by saying not only the N-word, but also a slur for Hispanics.
Yes. Yes. So let us not oversell the progressive nature of the film.
This is putting the cart before the horse, but I got to say that Justin Pierce, I think the actor's name is, he plays the most insufferable character I've seen in quite some time.
The white guy? Yeah, this was kind of the end of his career, essentially.
He dies in like 2000. Oh, so
he did? Shit, I should have read more about his IMDb page than that.
Yeah,
this was probably posthumous release.
You know, I'm just throwing this out there. If you're doing a posthumous release of a young man who had died presumably tragically, maybe cut him saying the ethnic slurs.
I would have loved if there was an in memory of at the end of this movie.
They show a picture of him, but they show a picture of him in character as this insufferable. I think in the 90s we had a word for this kind of person that I don't think we're allowed to say anymore. So I'm going to call him a Wafrican Wamerican.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Definitely a Wafrican Wamerican.
Jamie Kennedy in Malibu's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Abdolazal before we knew what that meant. Although he doesn't take it quite as far as applying cosmetics, but still, that's where he's coming from.
That's true. And a bit of a Lawrence, are you familiar with Trailer Park Boys?
A little bit, although it's one of those shows that's so deadpan it kind of doesn't register as having jokes to me.
Oh, okay. I'm reminded of the character J-Rock also, if you're familiar with the resident rapper of the Trailer Park, a white boy who thinks he is black and has a whole crew.
Hell yeah.
We just kind of roll with it.
This movie reminded me a lot of Trailer Park Boys. We'll get but into kind that of,
yeah,
later.
Like a little bit like Trailer Park, because of the kind of like compounding catastrophes is a typical like Trailer Park Boys season arc. I was just gonna say
the stupid plan and blackmail is something that I think Ricky and Julian would get up to.
That's true.
They wouldn't run afoul of a serial killer though, and it would just sort of fizzle out at a certain point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, the serial killer angle doesn't really come in. Yeah. I guess are we gonna do a summary for this one, Lawrence?
Yeah, well, let's do. Would you recommend this first? So, Dan, do you think that people should actually subject themselves to this? Honestly, like, think, look into your heart, and what would you inflict on a stranger? This movie or not this movie?
All right, I'm peeling away the layers of bit. I'm doing it psychically. No. No one should see this movie, but, and this is a big but, I still think it's a fascinating piece of trash for the choices that it makes. But I am going to say I don't recommend watching it, but I am glad that I made you guys watch it.
Twice, in Ronnie's case.
I'm just looking at the blackmail tagline on the poster, because this somehow has a poster. Money, love, and guns. It's payback time. That has nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah. Well, no, Ronnie, I put it to you. The main sort of engine of the plot is them attempting to pay a crime lord back the money they owe him.
Airtight.
Also, I'm pretty sure the lead actress in the movie is not the lead actress on the poster.
Yeah, woman on the poster appears to be an African-American woman, so I guess they thought that would be a little bit better at the box office.
You know, I'm not 100% certain that's Bokeem Woodbine on the poster.
He looks extremely jacked if it is. They definitely hit him with the Photoshop.
Yes. So, yeah. Ronnie, how about you? Would you recommend this to anybody?
No. No, I would not.
Very straightforward. I mean,
I guess if you want to see the white guy from Mantis smoke crack, but that's like a really narrow demographic.
Spoilers. That's like the him smoking crack is one of the few things I like because it's such a weird twist of he was smoking crack the whole time.
And yeah, I guess we'll get to it. We can expand on the crack smoking later because it also ties into the ham-handed ironic retro angle, which is again like a part of the Tarantino pastiche, I think, but also a more broadly 90s phenomenon, because you had that in Ren and Stimpy. You had the Church of the Subgenius was of course from like the late 70s and early 80s, but it was still going around in the 90s. My high school chums had a book of the Subgenius and thought it was hilarious.
The swing revival, of course.
Swing revival, that's right, was in full swing when this movie was released.
Yeah, and just, I don't know, in the 90s, we didn't really know what was coming next. It kind of seemed like history had ended. Just there, so we started looking to the past. And
Everyone was looking at their dog-eared copy of Fukuyama on their bedside, the end of history and the last man, and thinking, all right, well, let's do some pastiche, shall we?
Yeah. I don't know, the 50s were cool. Let's throw some of that in. Anyways, as for me... I'm going to level with you, Dan. I had a reasonably good time with this the first time, but that was also when I was half watching it and fell asleep a bunch. Mm-hmm. This time I paid a lot more attention to it, and I just didn't enjoy it, even on like the trash level. There are some weird choices here, but on the whole, I think that if you want to go watch a like good, bad movie to laugh at, the 90s was a treasure trove of like shit that's better than this. I think the average Tarantino ripoff will probably be funnier to you because they will at least be like more going for it with the writing. Here, the writing is weirdly, it's not subdued because it's full of incident, but in terms of the things the characters say, aside from a couple of the weird shit the crime lord does, it's fairly like just saying bitch over and over and not like, people expounding on how they think the world works.
Right. It's all, the dialogue is all very contained within the incident of the film. You're right. Yeah. That it's not, we don't get to hear what the Guntry brothers, I even forget the directors.
This was a brother, this outfit?
Yeah, this was, pull up the IMDb page.
Jesus Christ, I should do more research.
I actually tried to, and would you believe it's not brothers. A lot.
The Bluesy brothers. Holy shit.
One of them has never worked again, and the other one is an editor on the true crime show 48 Hours.
You know what? That fits, frankly.
Yeah, George Belluzzi and Mike Belluzzi.
Hell yeah.
The directors and writers. So this was a passion project. This was really, this was an auteur work here. I think you're right. One thing though, like, I'm realizing now that I think this movie does work best as if you are in a group of people you know are like-minded in finding joy in trash, it's probably best enjoyed among them rather than on your own.
the second viewing was most depressing for me. We were on the phone the first time.
Yeah, Ronnie and I were on the phone for the first go around. I didn't want him to be alone.
Okay, let's fuck it. Let's roll for the summary. Ronnie, so what we're going to do here is I'm going to roll a dice, and then whoever gets picked has 2 minutes to tell us what happened in the film Blackmail. And if they leave something out or forget or whatever, or they don't finish, then it doesn't matter. That's the summary we got.
Okay.
Oh shit, it's you, Ronnie. So we're going to mute. I'll set a timer. And also, the rule is we're not allowed to criticize anything you choose to do. So you could summarize the movie. You could also, I don't know, read some of your hentai or check your stocks. Or I don't know what you get up to aside from complaining about Timothy Zahn. So the world is your oyster. Oh, and you also like Marcel the Shell with Shoes On and watch Fanboys repeatedly. True. Like I have
you're rich... painting such a rich picture of Ronnie. This is beautiful.
Yeah. Anyway, so 3, 2, 1, summarize.
Bokeem Woodbine stars as Jimmy Best, a small time criminal who, with his partner Luther Wright, played by the deceased Justin Pierce, are introduced losing a boxing match, and thus they owe a lot of money to a crime boss played by Eric Delhams, who you might remember from Homicide. Remember that show, folks? Anyway, they decide that the way to get money quick is to have Bokeem Woodbine's girlfriend seduce a British doctor and film them having sex and then blackmail the guy with the tape in order to get money from him. This is a Trailer Park Boys ass plot if I've ever seen one. Anyway, it turns out that the British doctor is in fact a serial killer because, why not? And basically it's about 90 minutes of people trying to get a tape back and forth and people trying to get money, and it's rich with incident. And for some reason, Bokeem Woodbine, dresses up as a woman for a third of the movie, and, Luther, the white guy, gets his thumb cut off, and for some reason, I guess the girlfriend of Bokeem Woodbine falls in love with the serial killer, but not really. And there's a whole lot of stuff about them like going off together, but not really. And I'm perplexed at how this film got made or why it was made, and I shudder to think at what goes on in the minds of the Belluzzi brothers. Let's see, what else? There's the worst looking fake gunshots I've seen.
And that's it. That's time. You know, I think that's the first time we've ever had someone like basically kind of run out of things to say.
But that's all right, because that leaves it up for the discussion portion where we can chew on such elements as the surprise ending.
Oh yeah, the ending. Okay, so let's get into some high points, which is, I don't know if the ending is a high point or not, but basically it ends with Joaquin Woodbine and his white friend getting framed for all of the murders the serial killer has been committed and getting put to death. And then the serial killer tracking down Bokeem Woodbine's girlfriend and Bokeem Woodbine's son, and it is implied murdering them too. Which, this is a very goofy crime comedy, and it is astonishing to see it end on such a note of nihilistic bleakness.
and played with like the, it's the return of the ironic domesticity as well, because the serial killer shows up at her doorstep in the guise of a door-to-door vacuum salesman.
Yeah,
there were parts of this.
Remember those?
Where I was like, this is just funny games for idiots.
Yeah,
there is
skill at all.
It has these distinct phases, and I wish I could credit that to some sort of vision, but I think it's just because the screenwriting is bad and episodic. But yeah, you have like a beginning portion, and I think we should point out that the sort of the characterization and like the broad drawing of the characters is, I think, part of the most Tarantinoian, or it's the most attempted Tarantinoian stuff, because the you have your black and white partner duo of criminals, just like Pulp Fiction.
Yeah,
one of whom dresses like a 70s guy, just like a bunch of Tarantino characters. That's Luther, our white guy.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the crime lord character is played very campy, like extremely campy. He is a kind of disabled in an unclear manner, such that he uses a walker or is in a wheelchair, but he is also prone to shrieking in high-pitched gibberish at his East Asian girlfriend.
Yes, when he gets upset, he begins to shriek like a bird.
Yes, yes.
His girlfriend's literally named Yoko, by the way.
Yes, he calls her Yoko a couple times.
And she's credited as Yoko in the credits, so...
She's credited as Yoko? Oh, no. Oh, you're right, there she is. Oh boy! Oh, and the married couple who the serial killer Dr. Bill Fontaine murdered and is now like living in their house. Those were the Peckerwoods.
Yep, it's a very funny and very smart.
Isn't that
script.
Funny?
Yeah,
it's hilarious. A very smart script.
Because they're like, we've got a name here, so we better put it a funny name. And then they right. did Peckerwood. Nothing funny.
Hilarious.
This is just like if Quentin Tarantino had like a. His brain didn't get enough oxygen and he wrote a script.
Yeah. Well, it's another point of comparison, and this might just be the game of telephone, because I don't know. I'm not a huge Tarantino head. I've not seen all of his works. I don't know how this, you know, but I picked up a lot of like warmed over Hitchcock, especially in like the scenes where Bokeem Woodbine, in order to extract some money from Bill Fontaine, he had him write a check. So he's going to go cash it down at the bank. And so he dresses very smartly and takes the luxury car down to the bank to try to pull off, you know, just getting this check cashed. And in the aftermath of failing to do that because he went to the wrong bank, he gets a flat tire and is pulled over, and a cop comes over to see if he can help him out. But of course, Bokeem Woodbine is a little sweaty and flustered and is going to try to get the jack out of the back of the car when he pops the trunk. And oh no, it's two suffering, not quite dead people. The Peckerwoods are in there, and he has to slam the trunk back before the cop notices. And just that kind of like escalating, like just this ham-handed escalation of like, will he get caught at this or whatever, felt a little... like baby's first Hitchcock to me.
Yeah, although the solution of at a certain point he just says screw it and runs away is Hitchcock would not have done that.
He really does.
Or have the cop get his head crushed by a truck.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really saved by the bell. The cop gets his head crushed by a truck rolling up next to him, and Bokeem Woodbine takes that as his chance to, Jimmy Best takes that as his chance to just run away. And then the next time we see him is back at evidently their like criminal safe house or whatever you want to call it, where they actually live, where Luther has showed up with his thumb having been bitten off by Bill Fontaine. And the next shot that we see Bokeem Woodbine in, he's dressed as a woman.
And he will spend the rest of the movie until he is being led off to be executed, just wearing a wig and a dress.
And yes.
I guess it might be that he is attempting, it's a disguise, but he will continue to wear this like when they are wandering around an empty house and he has every opportunity to take it off. So I think that a sort of subplot that this movie does not care to expand on is that about 2/3 of the way through, Bokeem Woodbine put on that as a disguise and then realized that gender is a construct and dresses are quite comfortable and decided that he was just going to go with it.
Yeah, it's...
The second time I watched this, I think I figured out why he dresses up in drag, which is he's trying to impersonate Luther's girlfriend because he doesn't want to be seen as himself. Because there is a picture of Luther with a black woman seen in the movie.
I thought that was a picture of Luther and Jimmy Best dressed in his drag or whatever you want to call it outfit. Like, this is something he does regularly.
But then he's shocked to see like Bokeem Woodbine in drag, so it can't be like a super. That's true. I don't know what's going on, man. It's very weird.
Maybe Luther's just an idiot who has object permanence issues.
It would be in keeping with his character. I mean, he is kind of addled in the head. He's had his bell rung a few times.
I mean, I think what's really going on here, honestly, is that the brothers who directed this thought that Bokeem Woodbine in a dress was very funny, and that more Bokeem Woodbine in the dress was even funnier. So they just kind of kept doing it.
Right, which is like that's the level of stupid racism that is like lampooned on 30 Rock. Like they had like an episode on 30 Rock about putting a black man in a dress as a hoary old comedy go-to. And this movie was really trying to ring, like we said, like half the movie or a third of the movie with that little bit going on as they're, you know, trying to get away from the criminals.
It's almost as if they forgot to give Bokeem Woodbine anything to do. So it's like, well, shit, he doesn't have anything to do in the script, so why don't we just put him in drag for a while?
Yeah, he's in drag. And here we have, if you would allow me to, to put on my Paul Mooney outfit right here and, you know, get on my dashiki. Here we have the 1-2 punch of the emasculation of the black man, because during the entire segment of the movie where Bokeem Woodbine is done up in a woman's getup, is also the portion of the movie where his girlfriend is being seduced away from him, kind of maybe by the crack smoking serial killer white man. British white man. So, you know, but I guess we should bring up the, so Bill Fontaine, the serial killer, is smoking a pipe, like a wood pipe.
Yeah.
Like you
said,
classic 50s stuff. You know, my three sons kind of pipe.
He's wandering around. He's smoking this pipe. You're like, okay, that's a little bit weird, but he is British. So I guess it's cool. And that probably also explains
British.
Why he spent the whole movie wearing giallo gloves for some fucking reason.
Right. He's wearing giallo gloves. He's driving around in a classic convertible. He's listening to some Herb Alpert. You know, he's on that mid-century vibe or whatever. But here's a twist that we find about halfway through. When he goes to visit, like, some other woman he's seducing or something, or some other rich lady that he knows. Anyway, it turns out he's smoking crack rocks out of this,
whole
like,
movie,
briar pipe the whole time.
Out of his mind on crack. And then the woman says, it's okay for you to smoke in here. My husband smokes. But I don't recognize that blend, which very strange to me because I can't imagine. I've never smelled crack as far as I know, but I can't imagine it smells anything like tobacco at all.
Then
he just goes, it's Colombian. And you know what? That actually made me laugh a little because it was so fucking dumb.
It's the one joke that lands. Well, the thing is, I think it's a dumb joke, but it's a joke that actually fits the register of the film. And it could have used a few more of those.
I think the only time I laughed during the movie was at the shithole hideout of Bokeem Woodbine and Justin Pierce. There's a Vanilla Ice poster for no reason.
But, I mean, that is also exactly the kind of thing that Luther Wright would be into, I suspect. So
exactly. It's an inspiration to African Americans.
Yeah. And another thing, a joke that I enjoyed. So at one point, Luther goes down to the basement and trips and hurts himself because it's dark. And then later we see that the reason that it's dark in the basement is that Bill Fontaine has written a bunch of creepy shit in the blood of his victims on the walls and therefore disabled the light so that no one can see his creepy like graffiti until he's ready, right? Yeah. And the things he has written on the wall are, and I quote, "Die whore, Rocky raccoon, crack." And you know what? That's funny to me. That's a weird thing you write on a wall.
So I actually did not catch that, and that's actually a good joke, I think. To like, you know, instead of Helter Skelter, his Beatles song that he fixated on was Rocky Raccoon.
Oh, that's what's going on. I just thought it was a random word, and then also he likes crack, and I guess thinks women are prostitutes and deserve to die.
I would wager that the joke there is that instead of the slogan being Helter Skelter, like Charles Manson, which was of course he fixated on as a Beatles song. They picked the silliest sounding Beatles song, Rocky Raccoon, from the White Album, to be up there.
Is that why Rocky Raccoon is misspelled on the graffiti? Like, did the Beatles misspell it as well?
It might be. I don't know. I'll have to look. I hate that song, so I don't really...
You know what, Dan? I hate that you pointed out that the movie Blackmail was slightly smarter than me. You should not. You shouldn't do that again. This is my podcast, and that was very rude.
I am sorry. It looks like the song is spelled correctly. Rocky, R-O-C-K-Y. There's an added layer.
Yeah, in his murderous fervor, he spelled raccoon with only one C.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Anyways, it just raises the question, like, you know, how much of Blackmail is intentional and how much of it is just poor filmmaking?
Well, exactly. Well, that's the Zahn conundrum that we face on Thronderdome. Like, is this clever misdirection, or did Timothy Zahn just forget where he was going with this?
So, for instance, when the black crime lord shouts, "Get the fuck out of my office, ass bag!" Is that supposed to be that he's actually kind of lame and bad at swearing, or is ass bag like supposed to be cool in the world of the movie? We don't know.
There's no clue. Because the world of cool in the movie, like, I believe it starts out trying to be cool because, like, the credits are just a feast of late 90s cool. They have the kind of, like, the blurred way that they come into focus. There's, like, breakbeats, like generic breakbeats going all over it. Very cool stuff. Just the credits equivalent of some Oakley wraparounds. Just incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So I think this movie is a little bit at war with itself in, well, you know, I don't want to necessarily associate this movie with the masterpiece that is Tango and Cash.
Yeah.
But
that movie, the two halves of it are both brilliantly constructed and their tension is marvelous.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's a William Goldman script.
But you're right. I think it is intention between trying to legitimately be cool and also be a comedy, so goofy stuff happens. And so it's very difficult to tell where which, you know, is also what, I mean, that's Pulp Fiction too, right? Except that, again, Pulp Fiction is smart and does that well.
Yeah.
Pulp Fiction is made by one of the greatest filmmakers of its generation, and Blackmail is made by an editor on 48 Hours.
And his brother who never worked again.
And some guy named Michael Delphay.
Hell yeah. We love the Delphays, don't we, folks? I assume. I don't know anything about him.
Let's click that link.
Daniel made a remark about the music, and I want to talk about the music for just a moment, which is, the music sounds, as I called it, hip-hop Dracula porn movie music.
Hell yeah.
Also, we need hip-hop Dracula, Ronnie. I need you to start writing that right now.
That is kind of Blackula, isn't it? I mean, except he's not really doing hip-hop. He's more
Yeah, it's kind of pre-hip-hop, right? But more, yeah, funk and disco. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's in the...
Blackula actually had thoughts and concerns.
Blackula is weirdly a very well-constructed and good movie, aside from that 30 seconds where it's just a photo of that woman's butt.
Hey, yeah, tastes differ. That might be a great shot.
Yeah, anyways, back to the music. I'm sorry I derailed you.
No, the music is just like really cheap sounding.
I would not be surprised.
With the movie, which also looks quite cheap, you know.
Oh, it looks very cheap. Yeah.
Which, Daniel, it reminds me of like those to go back to Trailer Park Boys, all of the like greasy pornos that J-Rock would direct.
Oh yeah.
This is basically shot like a greasy porno.
Yes, and my suspicions are confirmed that in the credits that we have here on IMDb, and I will point out that the third writer, Michael Delphay, he has three other movies that appear on IMDb, none of which have any ratings. Like, no one has bothered to give them star ratings. Blackmail has star ratings on it. People have bothered to do that.
And also, I will point out that everything else he is a producer on, this is apparently the only thing he wrote. Although he does actually have something in pre-production, apparently, called Shoe Dog.
Oh, well, we'll have to check that out. Yeah. But anyway, looking through the production credits here, there is a music department. There is no composer or music by credit, but there are two music editors. So I think what we have here is a couple guys with a royalty-free music library called in to just put something behind this, you know, put something on this soundtrack for the
movie. I think the directors found a guy that was selling his CDs on the street.
See, yeah, that's why this movie feels so raw and so real. Yeah. It's from the streets.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I had one other thing. I shouldn't have laughed at this, but I did. So at one point, Luther is telling a story that should be horrifying, but is played for laughs, where he got sent to prison for, he says it's for robbing a Carl's Jr., although we know it's for exposing himself in a Carl's Jr., which also...
Sorry, Jack in the Box.
Yeah, Jack in the Box. Apologies.
It's apologies to the good people.
Jack in the title.
Yeah.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, so apparently he was so head up by the concept of Jack in the Box that he, you know, took out his Jack and et cetera. But anyways,
yeah.
And so he's like, I got sent to prison. I can't go back to prison because when he was in prison, apparently he was, you know, the thing that you'd expect to have happened to a character who went to a prison in a 90s movie. But apparently the man who did that to him was named Kunta Kunt. And I shouldn't have laughed at that, but I kind of did just because it's so fucking horrible. So
stupid. And horrible. And,
yeah. They're like, okay, a Roots joke, but the worst Roots joke you can imagine.
One that does not even have really anything to do with Roots other than a vague similarity phonetically.
I guess they were trying to show that the man who, you know, was African-American, which would, I guess, I don't know why that matters, but whatever. But you know,
in
what?
In the 90s, that compounds your humiliation, I
yeah,
guess.
It's, yeah. But, it, and also, are, this is played for...
Are you suggesting that a movie called Black Male has a weird relationship with race?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess we should say, I don't think we point out for the audience, now, you know how to spell blackmail, as in the crime. This movie is spelled B-L-A-C-K, capital M-A-L-E. Black male, all one word.
Yep.
Which, yeah, like who?
I'm gonna just make the assumption that the directors are white.
Yeah, if the directors were black and it still starred Bokeem Woodbine, that could have been edgy and cool. But they're not, and so it's not great. It's not great. Very little here is great.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it. So do we think it's a joke that Heather, the girlfriend, spends basically the second half of the movie getting drugged over and over and over and doesn't seem to mind at all?
I think that is supposed to be kind of played for laughs, yes. Not, and again, like that's grim to think of, but...
I just find it funny that he drugs her using a old-timey Coke bottle. She never asked, like, where did you get this? This is really out of date.
Now, Ronnie, I'm going to let you in on a little bit of Southwestern and Southern culture. So if you're in a border state, I don't know if this would have been the case in the 90s, but actually you will see those all over the place because they'll get Coke from Mexico up because they still use the cane sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup in Mexico, which makes it like a million times better. So perhaps that's what was going on. Or perhaps this movie's poorly constructed. Could be either one.
Well, this movie was shot in Connecticut, so sure.
Oh, never mind then. I don't fucking know what's happening.
Well, I would also say that around this the time this movie would have been shot, I was attending church. And at our church, we had... Shut up.
While everyone else was watching Black Male, I was attending Sunday school. And
I was attending Sunday school. Well, around this time, I was actually a little earlier than this. I would have been skipping Sunday school to read Timothy Zahn novels in the bathroom.
Oh, my God.
Also, are
that's
you talking
the worst
about
reason
when,
to go to hell.
Are you talking about when this was shot or when this was released? Because those are two different days.
When this was shot. What I'm trying to say is my church had an old Coca-Cola vending machine that had the glass bottles in it. So you would get a Coca-Cola, you'd drink it, then you put it back in the little crate because the Coca-Cola company would come around and pick up the crate of empty bottles to refill them and bring them back to your vending machine.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I only wanted to point out that this film was shot in 1997.
Wow.
And released in 2000.
Jesus,
it's a 2000 release. See, okay, that actually helps me out because I was thinking this was perhaps on the second or third wave of Pulp Fiction ripoff, but it sounds more like this was they started writing this like the very moment they got back from seeing Pulp Fiction, they started hammering on the typewriter to get this project off the ground.
Yeah, it's like you know, what if we took the characters of Jules and Vincent from Pulp Fiction, but we made them total idiots.
And also, Jules and Vincent are kind of good at some stuff. Like, they do successfully shoot those men, at least, and get that briefcase. Did Bokeem Woodbine and Luther or Justin Pierce achieve anything in this movie? Like,
no.
Now that I'm thinking about Pulp Fiction, the Bokeem Woodbine in the dress scene parallels closely the scene in Pulp Fiction where they're getting the Phil Amara's brains picked out of the car, and they have to wear those shitty t-shirts.
Oh, you mean the scene that no one remembers because it's got Quentin Tarantino in it, and you could just kind of forget that it happened because it's so bad?
Yes. The very same.
There's a distinct uptick in the quality of his movies after he realized that he needed to stop casting himself in them.
Well, again, you know, maybe that's the he realized he had done the homage to his hero Alfred Hitchcock, you know, enough. He can move on. So I guess I'm trying to think of like what I would call a high point.
I will say one thing that pleased me in this was that Sasha Knopf, the girlfriend, actually went on to have a career. I don't think she's very good here, although I think that is mostly because the script just has her be an idiot. This is a hateful script towards her character and women in general. So I'll give you an example. So she gets she's constantly getting knocked out and waking up new places and not thinking to ask what happened. And at one point she wakes up, she's like sort of upset by something the British serial killer has said because he's the biggest creep in the world. So he mollifies her by taking her shopping and then he refuses to buy her anything. But still, just the concept of you could go look at fur coats is enough for her to be like, okay, this creep who keeps like abducting me is fine. I'm going to marry him.
Yes. In fact, she's wearing a fur coat for most of that last third of the movie. She has the fur coat on.
And nothing else.
Right. But, yeah.
But I was
so she
was
can still, easily slip into nudity.
Yeah, but I was still quite, I mean, you know, she's naked a lot in this movie. She's attractive. I think that if you're attractive and get naked in a movie, Hollywood should reward you with like a workable career. And that happened here. So, you know, good. The world worked the way I think it should. Also, that applies to women and men, and intersex people. If you're attractive you show me your body in a movie, you should deserve a career. That's Lawrence's.
You should have. Yeah, you should. Like
that's my political belief.
Yeah, like Helen Mirren.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone deserves that. Who gets naked for us?
The aforementioned British serial killer should mention has had a storied career, perhaps the most storied career out of anyone involved in this, because he was the aforementioned white guy in Mantis, and he also was in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yep,
as the Sheriff of Rottingham.
Yeah, the hilariously named Sheriff of Rottingham. He was also married to Frida Kahlo in the movie Frida, I think. Yeah, I don't know. He's horrible in this movie. He's just like terrible.
Cucked by Trotsky. What an honor.
Yeah, but he gives the worst performance in this movie, which is kind of astonishing because he's over the top, but not in a way that's like productive, which is
Yeah.
I don't know. I would give it to Justin Pierce. He was really insufferable for me.
Hmm. Well, and he was so marble mouthed that just like the character itself is very pathetic and worm-like. And he brought a very pathetic and worm-like energy to it, but not in any kind of endearing way, only just like you're just sad watching this guy try to you're watching a character who is meant to be laughably inept at being hard and threatening. And it's also the actor is laughably inept at portraying that, which kind of compounds the patheticness quite a bit. Sasha Knopf, good on her for having a career. I'm with you. Like she's not very good in this film, but because there's nothing, no good could be salvaged from it. But you know, if it got her an audition or two that she was able to parlay into something else, then, you know, bless her.
You know, I'm on her IMDb page and like her reel is autoplaying. One, there's a surprising amount of blackmail in here. And two, there's an entire section of it that is just her like shouting at someone and then slapping them over and over, like different people, but just like different scenes of her doing that. You know what? That's amusing to me.
I think this reel was made with a particular purpose in mind.
Yeah. And then Justin Pierce's reel also has a lot of blackmail in it, which feels like an insult to a troubled young man.
Yeah.
I guess it's possible that IMDb is just showing me blackmail because I came to it from the blackmail page. But don't know. It's sad.
The guy who played the crime boss had a second career as an anti-Obama black conservative on Fox News.
And a lot of voice work. If you've played any BioWare, like Star Wars thing, like the Old Republic, you've seen him. I actually thought I saw him in something kind of recently, and I'm like, is that the guy from Blackmail? And then I looked it up, and yeah, it was.
Wow.
I can't remember what it was, though.
Now I'm just reading his anti-Obama posts, and he's comparing Obama supporters to people from Jonestown.
Well, you got to get that money somehow. And black guy who will badmouth Obama was a pretty good grip for a very long time.
Yeah, that was, buddy, you could just write your own check for a while there with that angle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we can move on to low points if you have any particular low points.
I'll say, okay, first of all, he appears to have started a movie called The New N-Word, which... Well, I don't know what the fuck that. I'll investigate this later. But anyway,
On Thunderdome, the new N-word is Nogri. The little imps we don't like. But
you know,
hate him so much.
This may be a side effect of me having listened to heavily abridged versions of the audiobooks for the Thunderdome, of the Thrawn books. But I actually have a lot of affection for the Nogri, although I couldn't explain why now because you know heavily abridged and 20 years ago.
I was going to say, if it's heavily abridged, I think I know exactly what they have taken out, and you were saved from the from the most tedious Nogri parts.
Fair enough. Anyways.
They're just these little grave-faced monsters that talk about honor. I hate them.
Oh, man. But, I mean, that's also kind of a description of Klingons, which I love.
Well, that does
shitty Klingons.
Right. It does come up on the show that they're like, much as Ewoks are half-pint Wookiees, the Nogri seem to just be half-pint Klingons. But not as well done. But that's not that we're not here to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. We're not here to defend or attack Timothy Zahn. We're here to attack blackmail. So I want to just relay for the listener a thing that the black crime boss does, which he brings Bokeem Woodbine and his hapless white companion in, and he's shouting at them for his money. And he's doing that thing where, you know, that a lot of post Tarantino, that true romance thing where he talks very, very slowly and reasonably, and then suddenly he will shout for no reason, you know?
Yeah.
That whole thing. And he's doing an okay version of that. It's not a hard thing to do, but he's not fucking it up. But then, to convince them to give him his money, he feigns anger at his girlfriend, grabs her hand, grabs a cigar cutter, and uses it to cut off her finger. And then he's like, I like her. I do not like you. Imagine what I will do if you don't give me your money, or my money. And then tells them leave. And then afterwards, it turns out that this was an elaborate ruse where his girlfriend had a fake hand, although he is still, of course, angry at her because, one, she is a woman in this script and therefore is bad. But two, she got fake blood on his expensive, it looks like a pajama robe. But that's such a convoluted and strange way of scaring these men who are already scared of you into giving you the money. Right.
That seems to me was pretty funny because... Because I was like, as it was happening, I was like, wow, that finger cutting scene looks really fake. And it's like, oh, so it is fake. And later scenes will have like blood and violence and stuff. And they look just as fake.
Yeah, the fake finger looks about as realistic as the real finger that the white guy will later lose.
Yes. Yeah.
This is all about thumb trauma.
Yeah, there does appear to be something that they're trying to work through about having bad things happen to your fingers.
And women.
Yeah. And black people, honestly.
And black people.
And Asians. We forgot there's this whole, a lot of weird stuff about Asians in here.
The henchmen.
Look,
no one
comes out of this movie looking good.
Yeah.
not the blacks, not the Asians. No, but the
this
the
is
henchmen.
One of those... This is one of those movies where it's like, oh, they hate everybody equally, but they definitely hate everyone. They just specifically hate black people and Asian people and women.
But yeah, there is some attempted humor wrung out of the fact that the black crime lord has a Japanese girlfriend and two East Asian henchmen. The actors credited here on the IMDb page have Korean names. And the characters seem to have Korean names as well. There's a Kam and Lee.
But then she'll later threaten, he'll later threaten, apparently they are Yoko's brothers, which is strange. And then he'll later threaten to have them deported to Thailand. And also Yoko, she is talking in the stereotypical, like, the Full Metal Jacket Asian sex or Vietnamese sex worker voice. So I don't know what the fuck is going on with these people, aside from that they are from Asia. Not a specific country, just Asia as a whole.
Right. They're from Asia, and they exist to do exaggerated Asian stereotype yelling and screaming and accents as they try to kill people.
And fail miserably because the figures of fun and not allowed to even be good at kung fu, the thing that Asian people might be good at in films like this.
I just got depressed looking at one of these guys' IMDb pages and seeing that blackmail is the last thing he's ever credited with.
Yeah.
Imagine that being your last credit.
Before you're just acting is not for me. I was going to say, real estate.
I could also see it as being like, well, I don't want anything to do with this anymore after having done blackmail.
So this IMDb page is kind of a garden of delights. Some user list that this movie appears on. Gangsta movies, which makes sense. Movies I Want to Watch, which has 294 titles that this movie should not be on. No. My mystery movie list. Horror movie, which only has one title, which is Blackmail. And then 2000, which appears to be just a list of the movies that came out in 2000. And Thriller 2000, which I believe is something similar. But man, I wonder who put this on for a horror movie.
Now, I love the fact that apparently we're in the middle of a blackmail renaissance. Because two of those lists, gangsta movies and movies I want to watch, were created 9 years ago. But all the other lists, my mystery movie list and horror movie, were both created 10 months ago. And 2000 and Thriller 2000 were 1 or 2 years ago. So after a bit of a hiatus, interest is picking back up in blackmail.
Now, I will good to see. I'll throw this out there. This watching this did kind of highlight to me what a golden age we're living in. Because the first time you mentioned this movie was like a year and a half ago, and I like went and Googled it because it sounded dumb. And the only place you could watch it was a highly pirated YouTube video that I believe has now been taken. They were doing that thing where they were like flipping it to try to defeat copyright detection. You know, that whole thing. It has since been taken down. But now you can just watch it for free on the Tubi app, along with basically every other bad movie you can imagine. And also, for some reason, most of the classics of Western cinema.
Yeah, a lot of really good movies. That's the glory of Tubi. That's where you can watch Babylon 5 in high definition and really get a good look at all the seams on the sets and the costumes. What else did I watch? I watched Planet of the Vampires
on
Tubi, which is a great Italian science fiction kind of horror movie from the 60s.
Yeah. With
beautiful sets and production designs.
And absolutely enormously impressive. That's like basically the movie. That and The Terror from Beyond Space are Alien is just ripping those off shamelessly.
Yeah. Which is then hilarious that Alien itself got ripped off so shamelessly. Well, it's a bit of a Pulp Fiction effect.
Yeah, it's weird. Alien ripped off an Italian movie, and then the Italians spent 10 years ripping off Alien.
Ripping off Alien.
Tubi is great because you can, like, in the search bar, you can put in any actor's name, and you'll find 5 movies you've never heard of that they've been in.
And they will probably, if you were to ask that actor about, they would either not remember or pretend they didn't remember.
Whenever I don't have anything in particular to watch, I'll just like put in Michael Shannon's name and just watch the movies that he has on Tubi.
That's not bad. Yeah. One last bit of information from the IMDb page that I want to bring to y'all's attention is that the movie ended up with a 4.6 out of 10.
Which is insanely high. Yeah. I was looking at it on Tubi, and I think it had like 6.9 stars or something, which is insane also.
Absolutely terrible. And that was from 393 ratings, which I am shocked that almost 400 people asked themselves enough to actually click to give this a star rating. That's really fucking crazy to me.
For those interested, on Letterboxd, it's been seen by 87 people.
Yeah. And you had 2 of those people are in this call.
And it's been liked by 15 members. It doesn't have enough ratings to get a score.
From the IMDb. All right,
so
sorry, from the IMDb page, the trivia is also, the person who wrote this can only be a kindred spirit to Lawrence, because it has one trivia entry, and it just says, features Sasha Knopf's only nude scenes, and then one person marked this as helpful.
Just a couple of Lawrences right in there. So I'm drilling down on this rating. I'm drilling down on the rating here, and I would like to ask you two, what percentage of these ratings... Okay, so we have 393 ratings, all right?
Uh-huh.
They're distributed on a 10-point scale.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What percentage of those ratings gave this movie a 10 out of 10?
I'm going to go with 20% because people are really stupid.
Ronnie, you want to try a guess?
I'll go with 25%.
All right. Well, you both either over or underestimated your peers. 10%. 40 ratings gave it 10 stars.
And this isn't even like Letterboxd, where people will quite frequently give bad movies high ratings as jokes. This is just, they aren't reviews. It's just someone saying, yes, that's 10 stars.
That is Jesus. A 10 star rating. Yes. Yeah. And the countries with the most ratings, I'm going to dig into this a little more. The countries with the most ratings are the United States, of course, the United Kingdom, makes sense. Finland, Canada, and Denmark. Let's see what the Finns had to say. Okay, generally they're not very positive, but overall the preponderance is not too bad. It's a 4.2 out of 10 for the Finns.
Now, Denmark, there is one person in Denmark who thought this was a 9-star movie.
That's right. There's one person in the UK who thought it was a 10-star movie, and it looks like the overwhelming majority of 10-star ratings came from the good old US of A with 14%. Of the United States ratings.
Those are only 24 ratings, so it is possible that those were all people who worked on the film Blackmail.
I do like how apparently in Australia and the United Kingdom, Blackmail is spelled the traditional way for the title.
They chickened out.
they thought, no, this is too fucking stupid and kind of racist. Let's change it.
That, you know, Ronnie, I'm going to object to the idea that anything could be too racist for Australia.
Well, it might be, for whatever reason, they might be a little sensitive to it. Like that we discovered in that episode of Thunderdome about video games that we recorded with Alex, where there was a Star Wars strategy game called Star Wars Resistance. But in the UK, that was changed to Star Wars Supremacy, because Resistance was just a little too... close to home with the IRA, I suppose.
Whereas, of course, the Brits love supremacy.
They love supremacy.
It reminds them of the good old days.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Anyways, let's see. I'm looking over my notes and seeing if there's anything else. I do love that this guy is kind of the bad guy's kind of a necrophiliac. I don't love it. It's interesting, I guess. So when he holds the Sasha Knopf, he says, I've never felt anyone so alive, and then goes in for the full-on nipple suck. Later on, you do actually see him having sex with the corpse. Although it's shot in a way that it's a visual gag that he's having sex with the corpse, because you think she's having sex with her husband, and then it's him, and then he flips over, and she's dead.
Oh, boy.
Yep. Yeah. So if you ever wanted to see the white guy from Mantis, as Roddy calls him, fuck a corpse, this is your movie.
I've often thought about that.
Yeah. Let's see. And then there's this incredibly stupid gag where the kung fu henchmen keep like trying to do flips and stuff and fucking them up either by pulling muscles or by doing them over broken glass. And it's kind of too stupid for words, honestly.
There's a lot that's too stupid for words.
Yeah. Oh, I'm now, the IMDb paid for Blackmail is now giving up on showing me things for Blackmail and is showing me a video from another movie. Which is a reasonable choice. I'm going to close this now.
Right. We're just going to keep going down that rabbit hole.
I never thought I'd be doing demography of the Finnish opinions about Blackmail.
Let's see. Oh, and also to prove that he home invades another white mansion, I guess so that it'll have a place for the end game, or just because he likes home invading people. And to prove, he does it by pretending to be the editor of Architecture Digest and the woman showing him around her house. And to prove that the woman is wealthy, in the first scene where you see her, she's directing people, arranging her furniture, and she has a riding crop. And then later on, when she's doing the interview, I believe she still has the riding crop. So she just always carries a riding crop, I guess, to prove that she's rich.
That's exactly right. I do have so the library that I work in is in the it's in an affluent part of town in the city that I live in. And I do have a regular patron who does show up to the library in her jodhpurs quite a bit.
Jesus.
So
does she ever like motion for you to bring her things with her riding crop though? Because that's what no, this woman does constantly.
she's actually very kind and like very good to all of the staff. Like, you know, she's not any kind of like domineering person, but it is kind of one of those like eyebrow raising kind of like, oh, straight from the stables. Good, okay.
Good old Stinkton Public Library.
Yeah.
Also, we see Luther like fight. Like his whole thing is that he's trying to be a fighter, I guess. And first of all, he fights in a gi, but he has a white belt. So it's like, if you only have a white belt, don't wear the gi, dude.
Right. And it's some kind of like, it's not like bare knuckle boxing either. It's supposed to be some kind of like super raw street fighting.
Yeah.
Because I think there's like an officiant of some sort who says like, no rules, last man standing wins when they start the fight.
Yeah. And then later on, over the course of the fight, Luther will, at first he grabs a, he somehow gets, they're cutting away from him getting his ass kicked. And every time they cut back, he will be trying something else. So first he's waving a pipe around and his opponent just grabs it from him and beats him with it. And then later on, he jumps on his opponent and bites his ear off. But this still isn't enough for him to win.
Right.
And this is sort of a runner with Luther, because apparently whenever he gets in a fist fight, even though he supposedly has martial arts training, his inclination is to jump on the person and bite them, because he will also do it to the serial killer and almost bite his nose off.
That's right. Yep. Yeah.
So he's a biter. Look out. Oh, and then apparently at the ritzy mansion they're in, Luther at one point is like, hey, bring me the most expensive booze. And he gets a bottle of Chivas Regal, and he's very upset about that being the most expensive booze. And you know what? He's right. That house should have had nicer booze than that.
I don't know. I'm a Evan Williams Green Label kind of booze drinker, so I wouldn't know.
If you can buy it at Costco, it's not great booze. That's kind of the rule.
That's a good rule of thumb. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, I don't know. Anyone else got any like other low points?
The whole movie?
Yeah, fair
the
whole.
I can't really think. I think we have talked about everything specific I wanted to make sure talked about.
I got another one. For some reason, the second Rich People house is entirely full of taxidermied animals, but they're all like reclining in that sexy like Burt Reynolds and Playgirl pose.
An interesting touch. Yeah. Perhaps it emphasizes the sexiness of dead things.
Yeah, I think that that's just what they could get for very little money at the taxidermy.
And that's why they were like, we need a lot of taxidermy animals, and like
how the room ends up having all those framed photos with spoons.
Oh right.
Yeah, that's what you get when you. Although the weird thing is, the room was actually made for an enormous amount of money. It was just poorly spent.
The room definitely had a higher budget than this.
Well, no, the room was like, have you ever read Greg Sestero's book on the making of the room?
Yes, it's great.
I have. Yeah, yes, you're dealing with scholars, Lawrence.
Yeah, but that whole thing where instead of renting the cameras, he just bought them all. Tommy Wiseau was like, no, I'll need more cameras. And then he bought them. Right? And then he bought multiple sets of them because he couldn't decide if he wanted to shoot on digital or film, I think. Something
and spent money.
And then didn't he shoot simultaneously digital and film?
He did.
Yes.
He spent money creating a rig to mount both cameras at once to shoot every scene in film and digital.
But crucially, the cinematographer was only looking through the viewfinder of one, so the other one was always out of focus.
It was always out of focus, and it had like other like parts of the set you weren't supposed to see in the shot, and just what a beautiful movie. Go watch a beautiful movie, well made, like The Room.
Yeah, at a repertory screening though, because The Room on its own is also kind of hard to take, honestly.
That's true.
Tommy Wiseau is a better filmmaker than the Bluesy Brothers.
At the very least, Tommy Wiseau had the bare, like the talent and the grit and the courage to show his penis and butt in the movie.
I would also say that The Room is more psychologically revealing than Blackmail.
It's certainly a work of deep sincerity.
Tommy Wiseau appears. There are people in The Room that Tommy Wiseau does not hate. I don't think there are people in Blackmail that the people who made Blackmail don't, on some level, despise.
No,
I think they even hate Bokeem Woodbine.
Yeah.
That explains why he spends most of his time in the dress.
Yeah. Fuck, I remember one last thing, and then we're going to go to something else unless someone else has something. So over the course of that really stupid, like, suspense scene where they're Bokeem Woodbine is trying to stop the cop from seeing the bodies, and they just blow up the scene. There's a poodle comes over and starts licking blood that's somehow leaking out of the trunk. And Bokeem Woodbine's solution to this is he grabs the poodle and ties it to the hitch of a nearby car, which then the cop sends driving away. And so the cop sees the poodle starting to get dragged off. And instead of just making the driver stop and freeing the poodle, his thinking, his genius cop move, is to go radio in animal cruelty and try to get them to send animal control.
That's right. He calls
it. He simply says a canine unit.
Yeah, as he watches a dog get dragged to death.
Yes.
One of the most upsetting things you can imagine. He watches Stoney faces like, this is someone else's problem. I am not going to intervene.
Where he's like explaining, he's like, yeah, I got a dog tied to a car. It's driving away. Doesn't that give him like the license number?
Yeah. I did think of my quote unquote favorite scene, which is Luther, the white miscreant, takes a pair of women's panties, starts sniffing it while watching the blackmail sex tape.
Yeah.
And he starts jerking off to that. Or, you know, we don't see it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the British serial killer intercedes on him, and they start fighting to the point that it looks like the serial killer is fucking him in the ass. And the girlfriend comes in and sees this, and is like, it's not what it looks like.
It's not what it looks like. I'm just attempting to commit murder.
I'm just trying to kill this guy. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Terrible movie. Fascinating to talk about. Might be fascinating to watch with friends. And the fact that you can get it on Tubi and it's only an hour and a half kind of sweetens the pot a little. But on the whole, if you're not Dan, I would say probably don't watch this. Dan should probably watch it again, though.
I should probably watch it again. Here's what I would say. Here's the ideal viewing situation for Black Male. You've been out with your friends at the bar. You've had a couple, but you all come back to your place. You're hanging around, maybe sparking a bowl. It's getting around 11:30 midnight. But it's like, hey, let's throw on a movie. This is the insane midnight movie to throw on. I've
thought of another ideal experience, which is for some reason you are best friends with Bokeem Woodbine, and he's like, hey buddy, let's watch a movie. And you're like, okay, can it be any movie? And he's like, sure, I trust you. And then you put Blackmail on you. You spend the whole thing just being like, what happened? Why are you in this?
I like the idea of Bokeem Woodbine saying, sure, I trust you. Like, you're my best friend, and I love you.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, that's kind of all I want out of life, is for Bokeem Woodbine to be my best friend and trust and love me.
Right. And I betray that trust and remind him of his shameful past.
Yeah, although I bet he has complicated feelings about this, because this is one of a very small number of movies where he was actually the star, you know?
Like a headliner, for sure.
Which is really depressing, because, again, he's not good here. He can be phenomenal in things. Fargo season 2 was great, and he is great in it. He's playing that, like, genteel, like, talking about the weather and etiquette while beating you up style villain, but he brings a real flair to it. And then by the end, there's this note of weird melancholy he's brought to the proceedings that I don't know if another actor would have thought to, like, put in that really works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways. Man, I should rewatch Fargo season 2. I guess that's what I'm taking away from this. I like Fargo season 2 a lot. Never watched Fargo season 3, but season 2 was phenomenal.
Anyways. All right. So
that's a great thing about Fargo. You can take or leave each individual season because they're all standalone.
Yeah. Anyways, let's go ahead and I have a game. And I think, Ronnie, I think you're going to love this, by which I mean I think it's going. I'm curious if it will make you shout. so this is a game I call 40K or 40 No Way. Now, Ronnie, do you know anything at all about Warhammer 40K?
I know it's for nerds.
Hell yeah. That's the target audience. So Warhammer 40K is set, like, in the 40,000 years in the future. And it's set in this grim, dark world where humanity somehow in, like, a technological dark age. And there's a million holocausts and a billion trillion bad things happening every single second. And also there's orcs and elves. And everything is sort of in fake Latin. So the way this game works is I'm going to name a thing, and then you're going to tell me if it's in 40K or not. Now, there are three different ways a thing could be in 40K. First, it could have improbably just survived all through the millennium and exist unmodified in the grim darkness of the 40th millennia. So, for instance, waffles exist in Warhammer 40K just as waffles, and they're called waffles. Second, it could exist as a kind of equivalent substance, but with a dumb sci-fi name. So, for instance, gasoline exists in Warhammer 40K, but it's called Promethium because it's science fiction-y. And third, it could exist as a stupid reference. So, for instance, Kyra Sedgwick exists in Warhammer 40K because, for some reason, an author was just like, I'm going to name this character Kyria Sedgwick, and she's going to be have one line and never come back. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. That's an odd choice. There we go.
I know, because it's kind of, I mean, when was the last time you thought about Kyra Sedgwick? Do you watch The Closer? If not, you thought about her when you thought about the film Loverboy.
I was wondering why she never guest starred on Major Crimes.
Or her excellent thing on Corporate. But yeah, not a well-known actress. Very curious why there'd be a reference to her in Warhammer 40K.
Mrs. Kevin Bacon.
Yep.
But as you can see, Ronnie, this is a bit like the game we're going to play with our special anniversary riff track. We're going to record a track to go along with the original Star Wars, where Ronnie and I point out stuff that exists in Star Wars so that you can be so that you can be allowed to include it in your book, inspired by the author note that Timothy Zahn wrote for the 20th anniversary edition of Heir to the Empire, where he explained that he did not use the term paper pusher when describing a bureaucrat because paper does not exist in Star Wars.
God fucking damn it.
Despite him failing to adhere to that as of the third book.
And also, yes. Hot chocolate doesn't exist in the fucking movies either, but he still put that in.
Well, exactly. So anyway, but Ronnie, so that's kind of the spirit of this whole exercise.
Yeah. And there's a complicated scoring system, which I will now explain because it is important and matters. So if you, I'm going to first ask, does it exist in 40K? If you answer no and it doesn't exist, you get 2 points. If you answer yes and it exists, you get 1 point. If you answer yes, I will then ask if it has a dumb science fiction name. Answering that correctly is also worth a point. And finally, I will give you a chance to guess the dumb science fiction name. If you can guess the dumb science fiction name, if you thought it had one, then that's worth 3 points because it's really hard to guess a dumb science fiction name.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're going to do Dan first to kind of give Ronnie a little bit of a flavor for this. So
Dan, who listens to Thronderdome, knows that I love dumb names.
Yeah. So Dan, sorry. Does
combine our names?
Yeah. Anyways, does Ray Harryhausen exist in Warhammer 40K?
Ooh, that's a big yes.
Does he have a dumb science fiction name?
Yes.
What is that dumb science fiction name?
His dumb science fiction name, version of his name, would be Rye Harryhausen.
Oh man, that would be so good. Now there's just a planet called Harryhausen that's full of monsters that like...
Ray Player One bullshit.
Yeah, I know, but at the very least, this is a minor thing as opposed to the entirety of the book.
Entire plot. Right?
This is just a winking reference in a sentence, not, you know... Anyways. Okay, Ronnie, does Immanuel Kant exist in Warhammer 40K?
Yes.
Does he have a dumb science fiction name?
I'm going to say no, because Immanuel Kant already sounds like a stupid science fiction name.
Okay, you know what? You're absolutely correct. Immanuel Kant exists in Warhammer 40K as just a character started thinking about Immanuel Kant and the categorical imperative. Although he,
what?
Yeah. Although he did pronounce it Immanuel Quant, and I can't decide if that's a British thing or like just they're like having that exist changed through the millennium.
Unmodified. Yeah. Over 40,000 years. But
okay, so wow. The scores are now 1 to Dan, 2 to Ronnie. So, Dan, does gelatin exist in Warhammer 40K?
Yes.
Does it have a stupid science fiction name?
Yes, it does.
What's it called?
It is called Gelzert.
It's just called gelatin, Dan.
Oh, no!
Yeah. At one point,
I'm giving them too much credit.
Yeah, at one point a character is looking... And a thing, and he's like, it was distorted as if viewing it through gelatin. And I'm like, okay, so gelatin exists in this.
So gelatin, so we got to put it on the big board.
Yeah, and this 10-foot-tall genetically engineered super soldier clad entirely in gold armor that he never takes off apparently knows what gelatin is. It's one of the custodies. That's why he's 10-foot-tall, Dan.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I from your context clues, the golden armor and all that, I reasoned it was Custodes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, good, good. Anyways, Ronnie, the cups exist in Warhammer 40K.
Do what?
Cups, just the things you drink out of.
Well, it would make sense if they did exist, but I'm going to say no.
Ron, they exist. They're just called cups. That was just me fucking with you. I'm sorry, man.
See, Ronnie, if you were up on your Blood Angels lore, you would know that, and I don't remember the character or whatever, but there's some character who carries like a chalice that's called the Blood Cup or some kind of shit like that.
Also, they're just constantly drinking cups of blood because they're also vampires.
They also be right.
They're, yeah. Ronnie, I'll have in, so in Warhammer 40K, there are there's a group of genetically engineered immortal super soldiers who are Italian and kind of angels and also vampires, and they are called the Blood Angels.
Look, I read comics, have... so you're never going to introduce something to me that's like too stupid for me.
No, you misunderstand. I was trying to explain something that I thought was all. No, I can't say that with a straight face. It's really fucking dumb. I love it,
but it's also pretty awesome. I mean, let's. If you want something real dumb, Ronnie, there's also some Scandinavian super soldiers who are werewolves called the Space Wolves.
Yeah.
So that's pretty.
That
dumb.
Just reminds me. Earlier, I was looking up the werewolf from Star Wars.
Who they cruelly cut out of the special edition.
Because he was not licensed by Lucas.
Horrible. He's like the best thing, and they replaced him with, I think, an Ithorian, which is an okay design, but less cool.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Terrible. Yeah. It's terrible how they butchered those movies.
Yeah.
All right, well, Lawrence, do we have another round?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's do one more round, which is Dan.
Okay.
Does the Bible exist in Warhammer 40K?
No.
The Bible exists, and it's called either the Delictio Divinatis or, and this is what I really liked, the Book of Canonically Justified Sufferings.
Ooh, cool. See, now I wish I'd said yes, so I could have tried to guess what kind of dog Latin name they would have given the Bible. Yeah. But you know what? I should have known, because Warhammer 40,000 draws so much on Dune.
Yeah,
I should have known that they would still have the Bible.
And also, apparently, there is actually one copy of the Bible still left, but they can't keep it locked in a vault and don't show it to anyone because it's too dangerous somehow. Which I can't tell if that's a new atheist thing or a hardcore Christian propaganda thing, but it's definitely one of the two.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing they say about, like, China, you know? Yeah. Like there's only one copy allowed, and it's kept under lock and key.
Yeah, and finally...
It just reminds me of that terrible movie, Book of Eli, where it turns out at the end, Denzel Washington's been carrying around the Bible the entire time, but he's blind.
Yeah, and he's still super good at like sword and gun fighting because it's a miracle.
Yeah.
Blind people in film are really good at sword fighting, I've found.
Gun fighting is a little bit rarer, though, but he's still great at it. I think, yeah, anyways, and finally, let's go ahead and Ronnie, does Soylent Green exist in Warhammer 40K?
Oh, jeez. That sounds like exactly the kind of stupid, in-jokey, winking bullshit that a sci-fi property would have, so I'm going to say yes.
Does it have a stupid name?
Well, Soylent Green's already a pretty stupid name.
Stupider than Soylent?
I'm going to say yes, it has a stupid name, and it's like, I don't know, Verdant stuff.
Oh my, this is, you were so close. It's called either Soylent's Viridians or Corpse Starch.
God damn it.
And the weird thing is, so they've got this stuff called Soylent's Viridians, and in the books they're always like, I don't know where quite what this stuff is, but then they also have a substance called corpse starch. So it's like, why, if Soylent's Viridians is actually people, why are they hiding it? They also have a thing that is people. Yeah. Anyways.
Right.
That's the kind of clever world building I've come to expect from Warhammer 40K.
And the 30 seconds you've been aware of its existence. Yeah. Anyways, let's get to recommendations and cautions. What do you guys think?
Yeah.
So in this section, we typically recommend something, but also if there's something you've done that you don't like, you can caution against it. And also, it doesn't have to be like it could be an experience. It could be a bad thing that can happen. It can be anything you want, Ronnie. The world is your oyster.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, recommendations and cautions. Dan, why don't you go first?
I'll go first with a caution. I just want to let everybody know that given the state of inflation in this country, especially rising food prices and a concomitant, corner cutting when it comes to quality on the part of large corporations, you might think you want to like treat yourself to some fast food one day, like get like a nice, satisfying garbage meal, but it's not going to be worth it. Combos are $10 now and they're always disappointing. It fucking sucks. Do not bother. Go get a sandwich from the deli case at the grocery store. Oh, my cat just knocked down a bunch of pictures on my desk here.
Hell yeah. Classic cat.
But, so you might think you want, a Wendy's spicy chicken and fries, but you're going to get it. The lettuce is going to be watery. The mayo is going to be, it's going to suck. And it's just not going to be as good as you remembered it being. So don't bother.
Okay. Do you have a recommendation as well?
Yes, I would like to recommend the works of science fiction author Doris Pisercia. Last name spelled Pisceria. I was reminded of her the other day when I follow the Twitter account of the wonderful SF Encyclopedia, edited by John Clute, which is a fantastic online database for science fiction literature and film. I heartily recommend it. Just spend a day cruising. It's really super great. But it was Miss Pisercia's birthday the other day. She has passed on some decades ago. But I was reminded of her work and how it is basically pick up any book with her name on it, and you are guaranteed a wild ride full of vivid, unforgettable imagery and just really the best that the kind of new wave sentiment of science fiction had to offer in the 1970s. I especially recommend two titles, A Billion Days of Earth and Doom Time are both very good. A Billion Days of Earth is set, as it might seem, on a far future Earth where sentient bipedal rats are recapitulating 20th century North American human society, whereas actual human beings have ascended to some sort of bizarre godhood and only rarely interact with the Earth's surface, and it's populated with talking animals. Into this milieu, an alien which just appears as a puddle of quicksilver lands and is a living land of the Lotus Eaters. It will communicate with the talking animals psychically and invite them to experience an eternity of bliss if it will just be absorbed into the quicksilver. It is one of the weirdest, wildest science fiction books I've ever read, and it is so good.
And I assume Doom Time is just about me from about 2016 to about 2021 when the excellent Doom remakes came out.
Exactly. It's a biographical novel about Lawrence's time with Doom. No, Doom Time is also, that's one that stuck with me. It's another far future joint. She loved those. But this one stuck with me because it centers around kind of a last community of human beings left on Earth from some kind of mysterious cataclysm. And they kind of keep themselves alive. There's a big nutrient vat that kind of feeds them and keeps them alive. And that nutrient vat is filled by a certain, whenever it recognizes that it needs to be refilled, it sends out a kind of siren tone out into the world, which attracts a small weasel-like animal who then come running in hordes toward the giant vat and throw themselves into it to be rendered into nutrient paste.
Huh. And that's the whole story? Weird.
That's not the whole story. That's just a very vivid element from it that I keep with me near and dear to my heart because the way the imagery is described is so bizarre.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds awesome, Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go next. So for my caution, now we've all been there. You're up like caring for an infant at like 12, 1 o'clock, whatever, late. And you're like, I would like some Taco Bell. And you get on the Grubhub app and you're like, I am going to order some Taco Bell because it is open. And Grubhub drivers love, you tip $10 and they're like happy. But I've done this twice in the last like 3 days. Both times they grievously the order, it wasn't even like, okay, they forgot a substitution. It's like they just randomly had a conveyor belt with random Taco Bell items, and they would just grab them and put them into a bag and send them to me. Not even parity in number of items. And the second time, the delivery driver sat it down, not on the chair conveniently placed next to my door, but on the ground, my driveway a good ways off, which meant that roaches got in the bag. So bad experience. Maybe I Taco Bell, a very vegetarian and even vegan friendly fast food restaurant. And I mean, I know the inflation is getting to us, but often you can eat pretty cheap there too. Not as cheap as you used to be able to, but the value menu has a number of actual values on it. But goddamn, their delivery service fucking sucks.
I will amend my caution to say Taco Bell is still somewhere where you can get your money's worth.
Yeah, because beans are cheap, dude. And they always be, hopefully. Yeah. But anyways, on to the recommendation, which is that I've been staying up at late watching weird movies with my kid because he won't go to sleep anyway, so I might as well use the time for something. And I saw... And he saw as well, and I assume enjoyed, Brawl in Cell Block 99, which is an S. Craig Zoller joint about Vince Vaughn. It really takes its time getting where it's going, so I don't want to spoil too much. But he, for various complicated reasons, ends up in prison and having to beat the shit out of people. And it's the closest S. Craig Zoller has ever come to making an action movie. And he's pretty, I mean, it's only got like maybe 20 minutes worth of fist fighting in a 2-hour movie, but it's really good fist fighting. And it's got this absolute brutality and degradation to it that you'd expect from an S. Craig Zoller movie that's really fun to watch. And people complain about his politics a lot. I think that he doesn't actually really have politics aside from a vague sort of 4chan belief that it's fun to own the libs. But I don't think he's actually like super racist because he tends to like include very well-written black characters in his movies, which doesn't necessarily mean you're not racist, but if the kind of racist your characters are espousing is a belief that like all black men are like sexual criminals, then you probably, if you actually believe that, you probably wouldn't have like well-written sympathetic black characters in your movie, you know?
Yeah.
But this one, he tones
rules.
Oh yeah. Brawl in Cell Block 99 and also Dragged Across Concrete is awesome. So anyways, this one, he does take out some weird like pro-life stuff, but it's very much in the background and mostly just Vince Vaughn beating the shit out of people while the human like body and soul are sort of destroyed. So yeah, check it out. And I also watched Nightcrawler, which is about my old man, my man Jakey G, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal. And he's just like a man who for some reason he has no conscience, and where his like mind and heart should be is a bunch of like grind set mindset shit. And he decides he's going to take the world by storm as a crime scene photographer who's selling like incredibly gory footage to like low rent local cable channels or news channels. And it is amazing how far he goes. And he is like a legit great performance that's so creepy and hard to watch. And
that movie also rules.
Yeah, I know. I have incredible taste.
As we've established.
Yeah. So yeah, don't order Taco Bell, but do stay up late at night watching those movies because you will have a bad time, but a good bad time, you know. Anyways, and Ronnie, do you have recommendations and cautions and such?
My recommendation is what I was watching before I made the ill-advised attempt to watch Blackmail for a second time, which is I was watching a Blu-ray I purchased recently called Primetime Panic 2, which is from Fun City Editions, a boutique label that I quite enjoy. Anyway, Primetime Panic 2 consists of three primetime television movies that were made in the late 70s to early 80s that are about hot button topics such as drug use and gambling addiction. And, they're pretty entertaining, like, you know, ridiculous primetime TV movies that are about, you know, couple of parents who, you know, can't deal with their kid being addicted to drugs, or, you know, a young wife who gets suckered into gambling addiction after she wins a horse race once. And they're all named things like The Death of Richie and The Seduction of Gina, which Seduction of Gina, you would be surprised, is about gambling addiction, not something more
it seems like it should be prostitution. Those.
I've been enjoying those, and for my caution, I would say do not watch the movie Elemental while ingesting edibles, because I did that like a couple months ago, and it was a very disturbing time, because Elemental is that Pixar movie where all the elements are like people, and I spent a lot of time trying to like map like what like is water supposed to be white people, or I'm pretty sure fire people are Italians, but that's about it.
Yeah, well, of course they are. They're very fiery people.
You know. Ronnie, if you enjoy being baffled, or I guess you didn't enjoy being baffled by Elemental, but I think you will enjoy being baffled by the excellent Episode 1 podcast, E1 podcast, just released their feature-length episode of an audio version of Pixar's Sodas, as pitched by Felix Biederman on Chapo Trap House a couple
months
ago. Sodas
sounds a lot better than Elemental.
I listened to it today while...
some problems.
Yeah, I listened to it today while I was checking in and shelving books. It is hilarious. I'm going to make that a recommendation also. Pixar's Sodas on the E1 podcast. Check it out.
Yeah. I guess my caution in general is to be mindful of what you watch while you're doing drugs, because sometimes you'll have a bad trip while watching a stupid children's movie for babies.
And I would just like to say that on the off chance anyone from work should hear this, I, one, have never done drugs, and two, strongly disapprove of Ronnie having done drugs and suggest he make better choices.
I should have made better choices than seeing Elemental, I'll say that.
Yeah. Anyways, from all of us at Bad Time Radio, don't worship Satan, it's bad at you, and I'm going to choke you until the little bastard pops out of your ass, which is a thing that is said in this movie.
Classic line of dialogue.
Yep. I mean, it stuck with me. I don't know. Anyways, thank you, gentlemen, and good night.
If you'd like to recommend an episode of Old Time Radio for us to listen to, send us a question for the mailbag, or a pedantic correction, you can reach us at radiobadtime@gmail.com. Our theme music is Finger in the Bottle by We Ashore Dedicated off their album No Ski Here Okie Sap. Thanks so much for listening.
Life's gonna gather it.